Bora, bora.
Okay, you are listening to WGXC 90.7 Accra, The Wave Farm. This is radio for open ears, and this is the newest installment of my show called Reading is Functamental. Every month on the second Wednesday at 10 a.m., I speak to a new writer of a book about music, about a musician. My name is Sal Cataldi. I'm a local musician in various bands and also a writer. I write about music for Rolling Stone, New York Times, Inside Out, Upstate New York, and some other publications. Today I'm speaking with David Sheff, who has written a fantastic new biography on Yoko Ono, a woman he knows very well. He was the famous reporter who spent about 3 weeks with John and Yoko right before John's unfortunate assassination, I guess we would call it. He remained friendly with Yoko for many, many years. And this is a book not only about, it really writes a lot of wrongs about Yoko. It speaks about her incredible art career. She really was a real edge pusher in the way of performance art and such. And it also obviously touches on her music. So I'm not going to take up too much time. I am going to hand it over to David Sheff to speak about his book about Yoko Ono.
Okay, here we are. This is the latest edition of Reading is Functamental. This is a show which is all about books about music with great authors. Sometimes musicians write them, and sometimes folks who are very authoritative, like my guest today, do. This is David Sheff, who has written the probably the definitive book at present on the very great artist and musician Yoko Ono. So thanks for joining us, David, and congratulations. The book is just out on Simon & Schuster, correct?
Yeah, Sal, thank you so much for having me on. It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, and again, it's getting really good reviews. You know, before I started penning mine, I read the review in the Times, and I was like, oh, maybe I better up my game here, you know? They did a pretty good job. I've written a few pieces for the Times, but not about books, but that's neither here nor there. So I first want to talk about your background in you know, your general background in writing and, you know, your life and how you got sort of into music and then segued into journalism and then how you came to meet John and Yoko.
Well, sure. Well, I was obsessed with music growing up. I was in a very conservative town in Arizona, and felt very disconnected from everything and everybody. And it was only late night FM radio that got me through. I mean, I heard, it was 60s and early 70s, and I heard all the big bands, a lot of the English bands, that just really kind of opened my eyes and made me feel like maybe I was not completely alone in this world. And so after, after I left Arizona, I ended up in college in the Bay Area at Berkeley, and got an internship at a magazine. Having no training in journalism and no real interest in being a journalist, I didn't really know too much about it, but it was really fun. It was at a time when so much was going on in San Francisco. The Jim Jones Guyana thing was happening then, and Harvey Milk assassination. I was working on articles on that and on the Zodiac killing. And so I really kind of got it and really loved it, but wanted to write about music because that's what I cared about so much. And I started to freelance for other magazines and newspapers and, a lot of local stuff, but aspired to get into the big papers and the big magazines. And so I wrote a lot of query letters to places like the New York Times and Rolling Stone and Playboy. I was able to, just by talking my way into this guy's office, I was able to get in to see the editor of Playboy in 1980 and convinced him to give me an assignment to interview John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd at the time when they were just making the Blues Brothers movie. As I was leaving his office, he said to me, by the way, do you have any way to get to John Lennon? And I was 24 years old and had no idea how to get to John Lennon, but I said, sure, I can do that. And I went home and started to write to everybody I could think of, all the contacts I'd made in the music business. Somebody told me to write somebody else who told me to write somebody else. And I finally reached a record producer whose name was Jack Douglas, who had recently been hired to work with John and Yoko on their first album after 5 years of living a very quiet life without making any records. I sent him a telegram for Yoko. He gave it to Yoko. I got a call the next day from someone who asked me when I was born and where I was born.
Astrology.
Apparently Yoko wanted to do my astrological and numerological charts and to read my tarot, which she did. And based on that, she gave me the green light to come and meet with her in New York. So I was living in LA then. I got on a plane. I flew to New York City and found myself sitting across from Yoko in her office. And it was from that original meeting that she finally agreed to go forward, and I conducted what became the biggest interview of their lives and the last big interview of John's life.
Right. And that took place over the course of, you said, 3 weeks in the book.
I was with them in September 1980 for 3 weeks. Basically, every day I met them in the morning at the apartment. They lived in the Upper West Side in the Dakota Building, and I met them up in the kitchen, and we had coffee. Then we walked over to a local cafe and had a second coffee. Sometimes went for walks in Central Park or around the neighborhood, and then piled into a limousine with and headed to the recording studio where they were making the Double Fantasy record. And so I sat with them and watched them record so many of the songs on Double Fantasy during that period. It was extraordinary. And occasionally John would have a break for half an hour, and so we'd go into this side room and I would talk to him for a while, or and Yoko would be working, and then they'd switch and Yoko would come into to the side room and I would interview her. And that continued over the course of that September. Finally, I was on deadline and I had to finish writing the piece by the end of September. Came back to Los Angeles, submitted the article. The article was published the first week of December. My editor in New York messengered a copy of the interview to Yoko and John over at the Dakota. And my phone rang on Sunday, it was December 7th. And Yoko and John were on extensions of the phone. I sort of had this image of them in the kitchen because I knew the setup by then and how they lived and how they worked. And they were completely thrilled by the interview. They felt that it was a time that they had been able to really express themselves and talk about their relationship and talk about their politics and about, what everything they cared about, their art, their music. And they were also excited because Double Fantasy had just been released and it was getting really good positive feedback. And so they were thrilled. And we ended the conversation when I said to them, I'll see you when I'm in New York next, because we were going to continue talking for a second article that would have continued the conversations that I had. I mean, it was, I talked to them enough that there was more than one piece in that interview. So we're going to go forward. And that was, and we hung up. And then, it was the next day. Like so many other people, I was home watching TV. I was watching Monday Night Football, and the announcer, Howard Cosell, came and interrupted the game to announce that John had been shot and killed. And, what can I say? I was as devastated as everybody, completely unable to believe that this had happened. I think we were all in collective shock at that point. It was inconceivable that John had been killed.
Well, this book is really what I loved about this book was much more the parts that I didn't know about Yoko's life. Again, as I had referenced in my earlier, my written feature for Pop Matters, I had been exposed to her art. I had seen the Yes, Yoko Ono retrospective at SF MoMA many years ago. But let's really talk about her childhood, her pre-war childhood in Tokyo, her family, the wealth, the class differences between her mother and father, and kind of how she was raised, and then into what transpired during World War II when she was in Japan.
People know about Yoko, but people don't know about Yoko's full life. They know about the Beatle years, and even that they know from the perspective of Yoko as this sideshow, to the Beatles and to John Lennon. Her life is amazing. It's so interesting. And she was born, as you say, in Tokyo. Her family was incredibly wealthy. They were one of the wealthiest families in Japan. Her great grandfather was said to be the richest man in Japan for a period of time. So she grew up with privilege in elite schools. They had palaces she lived in the summer palace and the winter palace, essentially. They had servants. But she was also very alienated and alone. And her parents were completely preoccupied with themselves, and she was desperate for their attention and affection, and she never got that. And they also isolated her from other children. So she was unable to connect with people. And so she felt very isolated. Sometimes she would call for a servant for tea just so she would be able to see somebody, anybody, a person. And as bad as it was for her growing up, and as dark, she had these dark moods she described. But of course, then war came and everything got worse. The family wasn't protected, even though they had that wealth. They were not protected from the food shortages, and they were evacuated from Tokyo to the countryside. And Yoko was left to, at 12 years old, to try to help raise her little brother and sister and try to barter family possessions like kimonos and antiques for a bag of rice. And I mean, she was starving. She got very sick. She was abused by a doctor. She had a very, very difficult, traumatic time
And
during
her
those years.
father was not there for some of the war, correct?
Her father was not there for most of the war. He'd been moved from, he originally he was he'd set up shop and was running his bank's operation in San Francisco, but then he was transferred to Vietnam, and so he was running the operation there. So Yoko's father was missing, and Yoko was raised then by the mom, who was really incompetent to be able to take care of her children during that particular time. So a lot of it fell on Yoko. And even when war ended finally, she was traumatized anew, of course, after the atomic bombs fell in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and she was moved back to Tokyo. which had been decimated by the bombing of Tokyo. So one trauma after another trauma after another trauma. And so she became, you know, a teenager who was, on one hand, she was devoted to, she'd become politicized and she was devoted to peace. And, you know, she became anti-war, staunchly anti-war at that point. But at the same time, she'd been hurt a lot and she was very depressed. And there was a period of time when she was a teenager when she actually tried to take her own life.
Yeah, well, you said, you know, I never really realized until I read this, the connect, you know, one of her greatest attributes is her work as a peace activist. And again, you know, I didn't really make the connection between being so much in the middle of that war and how that would you know, that would lead her in that direction, in that belief direction. The other thing I liked to hear is that you really did say that during the war, she did something that kind of informed what would later be her life in terms of creating these imaginary meals and menus for her. If you want to just go a little into what that was about.
The way that Yoko survived those really grim times, she said, was really through her imagination. And she would stare at the clouds, and she would find some solace there. Or the house that they were moved to in the country, the roof wasn't finished, so she would look into the sky and imagine a different world, a better world where things were not as grim and it was not as dangerous. She devised this way of helping herself and also her little brother, who were starving, by dreaming up these meals. She would make menus with her little brother. You know, let's make a menu and start with ice cream. And it was all about creating a reality in your imagination in order to surmount, you know, whatever was around her in
Right.
this difficult way. And so this, she said that that is how she survived. Her brother, however, when I spoke to him, when I visited him in Tokyo, said Yoko was able to imagine food and be sustained by that. He said it didn't fill me up at all. But that whole idea of imagining
Right.
in order to create reality, in order to create this mind trick in some ways to change the way we think, the way we feel about ourselves,
Right.
and ultimately to change the world, came from that period. And of course, that became the basis of so much of Yoko's art, and of
Right.
also some of her greatest contributions to the collaborations she ended up
Totally.
with
No.
John Lennon, including the song Imagine. It all came
Yes.
from this idea that if we
Yeah,
can
I
imagine.
mean when you realize where she comes from, what her belief system is, it's so apparent. The collaborations, you know, the credit that she didn't get for the collaborations with John, but we'll go into that later, such as Imagine. So let's talk about her study. So she was drawn towards music. She studied piano. She wanted to be sort of a composer in the 12 tone modernist vein. And she also studied philosophy, voice. So let's talk about a little about her education in Japan. Her move to the States and her time at Sarah Lawrence, and then how that all transpires to bring her into Chambers Street, the loft scene in New York.
After high school, she attended college in Japan for a very short amount of time, less than a year, and studied philosophy. She was the only woman in the philosophy department, but she found that the way that philosophy was taught at the university was very unattached to human emotions and psychology, as she put it when we talked about it. So she dropped out. Her parents then had moved. Her father got a job. His bank had transferred him to New York. So she went to New York to be near them and enrolled at Sarah Lawrence College. And that's where everything really changed for her because she discovered the whole world of avant-garde art. And it was a way that she'd been thinking about the world already. She'd been rejecting everything traditional and not, it didn't speak to her, traditional art. But here was a kind of art that was rejecting what they considered uptown art. It was rejecting what was being shown in museums and in art galleries or concert halls. And a bunch of artists had formed a world at Sarah Lawrence and even more than at Sarah Lawrence in New York, downtown in the village, of this new way of thinking about art. It was an art that combined disciplines. So you didn't just have to be a painter, or you didn't just have to be a sculptor or a composer. You could mix all those things. Another defining aspect of that art was that it was performative and often not meant to last. So it was about the experience of the art. It also was very much the first wave of art that was about involving the audience as participants. So Yoko's art at the, from the very beginning was a rejection of this idea that art is made by the artist in quotes or in capital letters and handed off to the audience in order to, edify them in some ways. No, this was about making people artists and making people create. And so her pieces were either these word pieces that would allow the user or audience member to have an experience in their mind. One of her pieces that I love was to sit and imagine listening to the sound of the earth turning. The art piece is, that's Yoko's prompt, but the piece of art actually exists when someone listens to that and follows those instructions. She did incredibly provocative pieces, like one that involved, another one that involved the audience, where she sat on a stage, in on a bare empty stage with nothing on the stage except for a pair of scissors, and the audience was instructed to come onto the stage and cut off pieces of her clothing.
Which is cut piece.
And that was cut piece. She did really sort of far out work, and she was also doing kind of far out music as well, which was about vocalizing and rejecting. She was a became enamored of and friends with John Cage, and so it was incorporating alternative sounds and sound, natural sounds and ambient sounds, and also silence in music. And she used her vocalizations as an instrument. Pretty wild stuff.
So
So.
how did they w was she I mean, this is just a general question. Was she financed by her parents in this stage, or how did they kind of make ends meet, or was it just that a loft on Chamber Street was like $7 a month at that time, which
Yeah,
could have
no,
been?
that well, you, what one of the things that happened then was Yoko met a guy
Yeah,
from
tell us.
Japan who she'd met earlier in her life, just at this random event, and they re-met and ended up falling in love and getting married. And he was this great composer, but he was not good enough according to her parents, and so they basically disinherited her. So Yoko and her husband Toshi lived a very frugal life. She worked in a restaurant for a while. She would perform Japanese traditional music and arts for the Japan Society in order to make, $25. And they scraped by. Eventually, she found a loft space because she wanted to have a place where she could show her work and show the work of other artists who were working, together in this world. And the rent was indeed, I think it was $50.50 a month. So she was able to barely make that, pull that off.
It probably did not have heat, maybe not even running water as it
No,
needed.
it was, I think it was, I forget if it was a 5 or 7 story walk up.
But yeah,
And it was big,
116 chambers.
yeah, a big, big, big cavernous space that had nothing, in there, including electricity initially. She had to run wires illegally from another apartment up there to get lights. But she was able to use that as a place to show her work and others' work, and it became this remarkable series of performances and concerts that she staged during this period, which was in the very early 1960s.
And that was like Peggy Guggenheim, people like that would socialize and come down there.
Yeah,
So, okay.
Duchamp came for performances, and Cage came and participated as well. I mean, it was all the luminaries of that scene.
So here's this this art star, and she well, actually, we should talk a little bit about Grapefruit, which came out of this period. Her work, which is, every museum I go, I think I mentioned in the article that I wrote about it. Yes, every museum I go into, it's in the museum store, as it rightly should be. It's a fantastic work, imagination.
Yeah, when Yoko was in Japan, she had concerts. And by then she was married to his second husband. She got remarried. His name was Tony Cox.
Right.
He became sort of her promoter and assistant and helped her create some of her artworks. The problem with a lot of Yoko's conceptual art was that it may have been kind of brilliant and inspiring and accomplish what she wanted to accomplish, which was to trigger experiences in people in her audience, but there wasn't anything to sell. So they
Right.
had a hard time paying the rent.
Right.
So her husband Tony convinced her to put a lot of her poetic instruction pieces in this book, Grapefruit, so they would have something to sell. I think it sold for $4 or $4 in advance, $6 if you bought it at one of her concerts.
500 copies, first run, right?
And 500 copies they printed. It's absolutely a stunning book, and
Yeah.
it has been in print since then. There is a new edition out now, and it's really the kind of book that you can read and you can reread and you can reread, and it brings a smile to your face because some of it is so whimsical. On the back cover, they have an example, her tuna fish sandwich piece. Imagine 1,000 suns in the sky at the same time. Let them shine for 1 hour. Then let them gradually melt into the sky. Make one tuna fish sandwich and eat.
There you go.
There are some pieces that are very dark.
Yeah.
There are pieces that are just sort of whimsical and about triggering the imagination and about expressing. Some of them express Yoko's passions, and some of them express her tr those traumas that she experienced as a young person growing up in Japan, about the war and about sort of this darkness. But that book became incredibly influential, and
Right.
many of the people I talked to for the book talked about reading Grapefruit when they were young and having it be transformative for them. Cyndi Lauper talked about the book as one of the great inspirations of her life.
Great. Well, that book, Tony, and that book, I guess, in some way, brought her to London, where she had a show at the Indica Gallery, and which is how she met John, which, we can go through briefly, but everybody kind of maybe does know that story, or maybe they don't, so if you want to do a quick recap of that, and then how they go to their first collaborations, the Two Virgins, and then Bed In for Peace, which is pure Yoko, as is Imagine, as is a lot of stuff.
So Yoko showed her work in Japan at her loft. I'm sorry. Firstly, she showed it in Japan. She also showed it at her loft in New York. And eventually, she was invited to a symposium in London. She went there and she performed Cut Piece and a few other works. And while she was there, she went to a gallery called Indica. And the owner of the gallery agreed to give her a one-person show. It was an amazing show in which she showed a lot of her works that included everything from a piece called Apple, which was an apple on a stand, to a ceiling piece, which was a ladder in the middle of the gallery, and you climb the ladder and you're sort of balancing precariously, and you grab a magnifying glass that's hanging from the ceiling, and you look up, and through the magnifying glass you can see little tiny words, and when you look very closely you see that it's the word yes. There was bag piece with the instruction that you get inside this big black bag and do whatever you want. This idea that you lose your identity inside this bag and you can so no longer be judged or prejudged because of how you look. The day before that gallery show was going to open, the owner of the gallery, John Dunbar, invited somebody he'd run into to come take a look at this work, this wild work by this avant-garde American artist from Japan. And that person came, and it was one of the Beatles. It was John Lennon. John Lennon came into the gallery. Yoko was angry about the fact that the gallery owner let somebody come in before she was ready to have visitors. Again, it was going to open the next day. But the gallery owner was thinking one thing, this is John Lennon. He's come in here and
I buy something.
he might buy something, and we need to sell some work here.
Yeah.
Yoko didn't know who John was. Although she had heard of the Beatles, she tells the story about her connection with the Beatles was hearing the name Ringo, because Ringo means apple in Japanese.
Right.
But she didn't know, that wasn't her world. She was in the avant-garde. She wasn't in the pop world. And so she didn't understand about the Beatles being the Beatles. But there was this guy in there, and she thought he was attractive and interesting, and he was funny. He took a bite of her apple, which kind of pissed her off, but also she thought it was sort of daring of him, a little audacious. And she walked through the gallery with him and talked about some of the work. And eventually he left, but before that, he really felt a connection with her because the work was so positive and really inspiring to him. And though they didn't see each other again for a while, they met again at a party. I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks later. It was really the beginning of a relationship that would change both of their lives. Eventually, they became friends over the course of a year and a half. They still were both married, Yoko to Tony, John to Cynthia. And but at the same time, their relationship grew and they fell in love over time. And it took about a year and a half for them finally to get together as a couple. It was huge. Not only did it affect their lives and their art, but it also affected the way that they were perceived by the public because that's when Yoko became, this hated woman. She was vilified as and blamed, blamed as the person who had kind of stolen our Beatles, stolen John Lennon. From the group and from the fans, and had captivated him, and was, the dragon lady who had captured this, hero. And it began years of treatment that was really appalling. A lot of the treatment of by Yoko was really racist and sexist, for sure.
Oh, totally.
And she suffered enormously because of it.
Well, so they did a lot of, like, as we said, collaborations, including this, Bed In for Peace, which, and I assume War Is Over was also kind of mainly Yoko's idea. Again, the music, as I said, I'm not particularly a fan of the music per se. How, but she's really has been embraced by sort of like a lot of bands. Like, there's a lot of bands that sort of boomers kind of did not really embrace to the degree maybe the critical world now thinks they should have. Let's say a band like Love, Arthur Lee and Love, and then this other generation comes in and kind of elevates them. So she has a lot of current champions. So if you could talk about some of the musicians she influenced and how that's changed the view of her as a musician.
Yeah, because when she and John got together, when people heard her music, these were people who came by way of, the Beatles. So, All You Need Is Love and She Loves You. I mean, they heard Yoko's music, which is really far out wild stuff. I mean, Yoko is, screaming and warbling and yelling and caterwauling and moaning, and it's all about expressing the deepest, most profound feelings, everything from the most profound pain to ecstasy in a really alternative way. People describe Yoko's vocalizing as if she's using her voice as an instrument in the same way that someone like John Coltrane used,
And she
the
collaborated with Ornette Coleman, right?
and
In
she could
the concert.
collaborate with Ornette Coleman and who played saxophone while Yoko sang. But a lot of people didn't get it and they really hated it. That changed over time. One of the things I found out about Yoko's music is that for people who were outside of that mainstream pop world, but who were much more in the art world, they got Yoko's music, and it was incredibly profound for them, and it was a huge influence for them. So I was able to talk to people like David Byrne, Kim Gordon from Sonic Youth, Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth, Laurie Anderson. I didn't speak to Patti Smith, but she has talked about Yoko as an influence. I talked to RZA. All these people who listened to Yoko's music and were influenced by it, it affected their own output later on, and they look to Yoko as a pioneer. Sean Lennon talks about his mom being one of the first punk rockers, and in fact, it's really true because she ignored all the rules. She did what she wanted. She made incredibly crazy sounding but powerful and music that, when I listen to it, it thrills me. John himself, John Lennon said, he felt Yoko's music was as important, if not more important, than anything the Beatles ever did. And
Well,
though they
there's
were
a famous thing about him saying, I guess he was in the Virgin Islands and he heard the B-52s and he goes, oh, somebody gets it. I guess
Yes.
he heard La Rock Lobster or Planet Claire or something like that.
That's exactly right. Yeah, Rock Lobster, he said, was Yoko's, a take on Yoko's music. And later, the B-52s also were a band that said that they were inspired by Yoko.
So her biggest success, though, but she did, again, musically, she got another boost when all these remixes started of tunes like Kiss, Kiss, Kiss. If you could talk a little bit about that era. She was on her own on top of charts, the dance charts at that time.
Yeah, she ended up having, I think it was 13 or maybe even 14 number one dance chart singles, hits. That
Wow.
was, it's amazing because this was much later in her life. Yoko was in her 80s. She was approached by some DJs who wanted to remix her songs, and initially she said no. But some convinced her, and I think the first song they may have remixed was Walking on Thin Ice.
Right.
I'm not sure. I think that's what it was. And it immediately became a hit in dance clubs. And it became to the point that the New York Times called her a dance club diva.
Yeah.
Again, she was in her 80s when this happened. So she had this whole other sort of wave of interest in her work. And that was happening at the same time as some of these more avant-garde artists on the edge were also embracing Yoko's music. So finally, Yoko was seen for what she was, which was on the cutting edge of music, just like she was in the art world.
Right. Now, at the time that these she reemerged, let's say, in this dance world was sort of when she also really reemerged as an artist when she had the Yes, Yoko Ono, the Japan Society created I guess it was the first giant retrospective, which then traveled to a bunch of museums all over the Walker Art Center. I saw it at SF MoMA. So if you could talk a little bit about that and how that came about. Also, the work with Deitch Projects, Jeffrey Deitch.
Yeah, so Yoko did have the first b even before the music was acknowledged to be important and influential, there were people in the art world who started to look at Yoko's art, her early work that she was doing in the 60s and 70s. They looked at it with fresh eyes and realized how profound it was. A lot of people got credit for launching conceptual art. But they were all men.
Right.
Yoko was looked over. And in fact, Yoko would be hanging out with these same guys who were said to be like the fathers of conceptual art.
The
And
Cal Arts, the post, they call it post studio.
yeah,
Yeah, the post
and
studio
she was
Cal.
asked to, she was the one who was asked to go make tea. So there was sort of this misogyny and this sexism
Right.
that followed her wherever she went. But the fact is that her art was profound and really beautiful. And she had, when finally it was pulled together in this exhibition at the Japan Society that you're describing, it was the first time the art world really paid attention to her and saw she still wasn't accepted by everybody. There was still
Right.
a lot of snobism. Some of it she was dismissed as her art being hippie art by one critic. But the exhibition was seen as a place where it really pulled together in a retrospective, her body of work up until that point, and she got a lot of attention for it, and people kind of got it. Oh, okay, so Yoko is this amazing artist who is creating this profound work. That led to some exhibition shows at, for instance, Jeffrey Deitch's Deitch Projects, and Mary Boone had exhibitions of her work, and she completely, expanded her work so that she was making new kinds of visual art. She was making sculptures. She was doing performances at these events. And it was mind-blowing. And when finally they pulled together that show that you saw that traveled from New York, and eventually I saw it in San Francisco too,
Yeah, I said
Museum of Modern Art, that's when I think people really got it. It's like, okay, this is a consistent vision for a new way of making art, a new way of thinking about art, and it's really profound and really moving.
Well, again, you could see the entire influence on their collective work, and even more, as much the work that came out in John's name alone, which really the DNA, the thought patterns, John Lennon was not a peacenik. He was kind of a, when he was young, he was kind of a teddy boy thug, beat people up and get in fights and and then all of a sudden he meets Yoko, and it became all about peace, and this is the kind of stuff that really did come from Yoko. I wanted to touch on she went through a lot after John's death, and you, as I mentioned, you did meet them, you spent 3 weeks with them, and then you continued to have, and really do continue to have, a relationship with Yoko as a friend and a sounding board. So, but what happened after John's death? She put up with a lot: death threats, assistants stealing stuff, tell-alls, people trying to write tell-all books, dubious psychics. So if you want to talk a little bit about what she went through there, and then also your own how your own dealings with her in relation, personal relation.
Yeah, when John died, Yoko said to me, she couldn't imagine things ever getting worse, but that was just the beginning of a nightmare because, you just really summed up what she went through. She was recovering. Well, she never fully recovered, really, from the horror of John's death. I mean, she was standing next to him when John was shot, and the trauma was such that, I mean, she was just devastated, and she often said to me that she would not have survived it if it were not for the fact that she and John had their child, Sean Lennon, who needed her. I feel like her recovery happened very slowly, and it was then that the people descended, and as you say, she was a employee who was trusted. Stole from her. People saw her. She relied a lot on psychics, who were collaborating with one another in order to deceive her. She paid them a fortune. She had, at the same time, this amazing ability to go to work, to continue to work, even as she struggled to survive. The worst part of it was the threats on her life, and they were consistent. I mean, there were so many people that reached out to her after John died, and thousands and countless thousands of people wrote with their condolences and their shared grief and their shared love. But there were people who reached out and threatened her life, and so she became incredibly terrified. And she suddenly, this woman who had devoted her life to peace, was always wherever she went, wherever we went together, was followed by at least two security guards. She did return to the recording studio soon after John died, and she created the Walking on, she finished the Walking on Thin Ice song and created the album, Season of Glass,
Right, with the
which on the
glasses.
cover, yeah, on the cover it has a photograph of John that Yoko took of John's glasses covered with his blood from when he was killed. It's a brutal album, and it's an expression of her grief and her pain and her rage.
And
It's also incredible.
that was his final session, right? He recorded that guitar solo, I believe, on the last night, and I think that's what he was doing the last night of his
Yeah, on Walking on Thin
wild.
Ice.
Yeah, the guitar solo, yeah, pretty
Yeah,
wild.
that was their last collaboration.
Oh.
So she really struggled to survive, and work is how she made it through.
And real estate.
Sorry.
And real estate.
She
Real
also
estate.
became, she had turned to business when John was
Right.
still alive. She started to manage, their business with Apple and all of her personal finances, the John and Yoko catalog, Lenono, their publishing company. And she was an incredibly successful businesswoman who relied a lot on, just like she chose me as the interviewer by using my numerological and astrological charts. She did conduct a business using tarot and numbers and, astrology. And she ended up amassing a fortune. I think right now they're, that she's worth about a half a billion dollars.
Whenever I read anything about them, about her, I always find out. I'm like, I was just my daughter just moved out to Los Angeles, so I was like, I just read something that he had a place in Laurel Canyon, and I was like, I didn't know he had a place in Laurel Canyon, and Cold Spring, and obviously now she has moved up to this farm they have out, I think it's outside of Syracuse, 600 acres, Holston cows, and
Upstate somewhere, I'm not sure exactly where it
Yeah,
is,
I
but
think they
a
don't really.
600-acre dairy farm.
Yeah.
But they had that. She had apartments, more than one apartment in the Dakota.
Right.
Elton John made fun of that, that she had so much, real estate. And this Cold Spring Harbor house I visited for frequently, like you mentioned. And there was a
Right.
mansion, a huge place on Billionaires Row in Florida.
It's Palm, like.
At the same time, she lived a very quiet life after John died, and it was really devoted to two things. It was devoted to work and her family. She had a very her relationship with her daughter that she had with Tony Cox had been interrupted because Tony,
Right.
when Kyoko was her name, when Kyoko was young, kidnapped Kyoko, and so Yoko wasn't able to see her daughter for decades, and Yoko pined for Kyoko, and it was really heartbreaking for her. It was another trauma that she suffered, losing her daughter. She was able to to maintain a relationship with Sean that lasted, throughout their whole time together, and they got to be incredibly close and ended up working together. And Sean performed with Yoko and produced her records, and they
And
toured around the world
yeah,
together.
many tribute albums, tribute concerts to her. I did reference at the in my piece with Pop Matters two things that I think you did not mention in the book, which were these videos of which, unfortunately or fortunately, they're very popular on the internet. Is the video of Yoko sitting in with Chuck Berry and Mike Douglas, and the whole Mike Douglas show thing is an intriguing thing, which is pure Yoko, how she kind of took over mainstream America, mainstream television, and brought all these people in, Jerry Rubin. There's a great documentary on that, and then this MoMA retrospective, the vocalization, which it's been countlessly remixed. So as I was telling, I was at a recent art show in LA, and there was a guy who had done a painting of Elon Musk, and we go by it, and everybody was like kind of giving the finger to the painting of Elon Musk and taking selfies. And this poor artist was there, and I was telling the artist, I said, "Look, you're getting a reaction, Isn't that the whole point here?" So tell us a little bit, let's talk a little bit about that whole Mike Douglas thing, not just the musical performance, but how that all came about. And that was with Roger Ailes, was the producer, I believe, at that time of that show, the man who, the monster, excuse me, who created Fox News.
I didn't know that Ailes was the one that did that. That's
Oh,
amazing.
Roger Ailes was he was a producer of the Mike Douglas show.
Mike Douglas show, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mike Douglas turned over the reins, basically, of his show for a week to Yoko and John. They were able to have on as guests, their radical cohorts, people that were in the anti-war movement with them, and also some musical guests. And it's amazing to watch. It's a lot of it's online,
And
and
there's a documentary too.
it was made. I was going to say a lot of it's online, and it was made into a documentary. And it's worth watching because it's so much fun. I mean, they are great, and and if you imagine them in the millions of American living rooms, the part of that show that week that got the most attention, and continues to get the most attention, was when Chuck Berry came on. And Chuck Berry was one of John's heroes, and the two of them together performed, and Yoko was at a microphone singing along with them, using her vocalizations. And there's a shot where Chuck Berry is frozen in frame, looking at Yoko, not completely not understanding what's going on, and people have made fun of that. On the other hand, Yoko and John thought it was one of the greatest things ever because, of
Right.
course, here was an opportunity for John to bring together his two loves,
Right.
the avant-garde music that Yoko
Right.
brought and his rock and roll past, which is what he loved. He continued to his whole life loved the pure original rock and roll music. The screaming at the Museum of Modern Art, one of Yoko's pieces is called Scream Piece, and she instructs that might not be the name of it, I can't remember, but what she instructs the audience to do, her people to do, is to scream against the wind, against the wall, against the mirror, whatever it is. It's not exactly right, but that's the point. It's about screaming out your rage, whatever it is you're feeling. And Yoko does it in a performance at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. She also, when the first time Donald Trump was elected president, Yoko released a tweet,
That's great.
which she attached to the tweet an audio recording of her screaming for 90 seconds. It's funny because there's so much that is in the book, but there's so much that I had to cut out of the book. At one point, all of that was in there. I had the book came out about 100,000 words, which is, I guess, normal for a book. At one point, I had about 400,000 or 500,000 words in there. So, trimming, deciding what to keep, it was painful to let go of so much of what I had to let go of.
Yeah, well, it's
But
how it goes.
Yoko's vocalizing, you can see it online, which is partly what's so cool about a lot of this stuff has been
Well, what's
documented.
really cool about it is, look, if she was Don Henley, she would have shut down all this stuff. And she kind of that's what I kind of like about it. She lets it go. She lets it go out. It is entertaining. Some of the, mashups are always they're kind of hit and miss. But the fact that, Apple, whoever it is, Sony, whoever owns their rights now, they just can like slam the door shut, and it hasn't been slammed shut. So I think it's part of maybe her collective participatory art attitude.
I think that's right. I think you're absolutely right. Part of the deal that, Yoko told Bob Gruen, the photographer, once that, if half of the people didn't walk out of one of her performances, then she failed. So she wanted to put it all out there, and she wanted to disturb people. She wanted people to, some people not to understand and to get pissed off about it. She wanted to elicit a reaction. And if she did, she felt it was a success. And so, a lot of the work is out there because she wants people to see it. She didn't want to be in an ivory tower. It was part of that same ethic that she had when she first started in the Village in New York in the 60s and 70s. She was rejecting the traditional way of packaging art and music
Well,
and
that
doing.
wasn't her. Yeah, that was a very punk attitude, like you say. It was like the original punk. And then the other thing is, as time goes on, like people like myself, I came to see her art, and I really understood how what a great thinker is. And beyond the great conceptual thinking, there's a pure heart, and there's like this, a woman who is a feminist, who is a peace activist, who's gone through a lot. So I think, your book. People absorbing the totality of her life, like I said, I think I said that, what happened before and after the Beatles is way more interesting to me than what happened within that 8 year period or whatever that she was with whatever. She was only with John maybe like 12 years or something like that, right?
Yeah,
13.
from the time they met, so they were together 12 years. From the time
She's
they met,
92 years old and going.
I was 16. Yeah, and now she's 92 years old.
Well, I also want to tell people that you wrote a fantastic book about your own life and your own son, your issues, called Beautiful Boy, which was turned into a movie. If you want to tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, in the middle of everything in my life, I had, a child. I was it was in, He was born in 1982, Nick. He was my beautiful boy. I used to sing the John Lennon song to him when he was, a baby. And when he grew up, when he became a teenager, he started to use drugs, and I did what I could to try to stop it, but his drug use escalated until he became addicted to methamphetamine and heroin, and he was in terrible shape and easily could have died. After about 10 years of trying to help him, including a period of time when Yoko actually was instrumental in helping him, getting him into treatment, She was a very loyal friend, as well as, I mean, which is something I think people don't know about her, that she, how giving and kind she was to her friends and has been to me. And so she really helped Nick get into treatment and saved his life at a time when he was on the streets of San Francisco. Nick was doing better. He was in recovery, and I wrote the book Beautiful Boy. I wanted other people to know. We thought, this is something that could never happen to our son. I thought that, and I wanted people to know that yes, it can happen. And I wrote an article about it for the New York Times, and then that turned into the book Beautiful Boy. I asked Yoko how she felt about me using John's song as a title for the book, and she was, really supportive of that idea. The book came out, and it really connected with a lot of people because so many people are suffering from their own addiction or the addiction of someone they love. And it's not a subject that people were talking about much at all. And eventually, Plan B, the production company in Los Angeles, optioned the book for a movie, and they made a film with it. And Steve Carell plays me, which is weird. It's like a thought playing me. Timothée Chalamet plays Nick, who's now Timothy is now, Bob Dylan. And the cool thing about the movie is it just reached so many more people who also were struggling with addiction, trying to figure it out and trying to navigate, that world when, it's hard when somebody becomes addicted and it's somebody you love. And it continues to show, and to people continue to read the book, and I hear from people every day, telling me their stories, sharing their stories.
Well, I think you'll also be hearing from people about this book, and hopefully you'll be talking to Yoko about it soon. It's a really fantastic read. And it really exposes a part of a fascinating and a steadfast person in her beliefs that more people need to know about what she was before and what she was after. And obviously you guys are have a special relationship, and you've written a very special book for her. So thank you for joining us, and we'll be talking to you soon.
All right. Well,
Hang on.
Sal, thank you so much. It was a great, great, great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.